Chapter 10. It was a strikingly beautiful morning in November. But a November morning some 12 degrees south of the equator has few associations with Guy Fawkes or bonfires. The dear t'gallant breeze had chased away any hint of mist the night might have left, and this was a light-filled day with a deep blue sky from horizon to horizon, a transparent air that allowed small details to be seen a great way off. And although when the sun reached his zenith, the exact height to be measured by every soul aboard who could command a sextant, quadrant or backstaff, his warmth might be troublesome. But Euphroes were already at hand for the awnings that would moderate his zeal, and while the boatswain and his mates were laying out the intricacies of their lines fore and aft, Jack Aubrey stood leaning on the elegant taffrail of the Surprise, gazing somewhat eastward of her wash at the boat pulling towards her from the vessel registered as Ganymede but universally called the Lisbon Packet, that having been her vocation before her owner, as unlucky in cards as he was in love, sold her to a penurious entomologist who, having inherited a prodigious fortune, indulged himself and his colleagues of the Royal Society in an equally prodigious voyage. One of the friends sailing with him, the foremost European authority on voles, was also in holy orders. And this being Sunday, he was coming aboard the frigate to officiate and perhaps to read a sermon. "He'll not be disappointed," observed her captain, having glanced forward and aloft at the snowy canvas, in charming contrast with her yards gleaming with Mr. Harding's blacking. Though to be sure the sails were somewhat given to flapping now that Surprise had started her sheets to allow the boat to catch up. But the person to whom the remark was addressed gave no more than a brutish grunt, clapped his telescope to, and said, "He's only an aberrant frigate bird." Those curious marks were certainly the excrement of some companion. Jack was on the edge of a witty reply, but before he could both formulate and utter it, the boat was alongside. The guest had to be received with due ceremony, and led below to drink a glass of sherry and to put on the rolled-up surplice that was handed up after him. Yet since the Reverend Mr. Hare had by now been afloat for so many thousand miles, it was reasonable to suppose that he might like to have some of the new rigged Surprise's perfections pointed out. But Jack might as well have addressed his words to a vole, for Hare was as insensible to the blacking as he was to the unusual cut of the flying jib. In fact, he quite dreaded reading his sermon. And once below, he gulped down his sherry and looked wistfully at the decanter. However, when he came on deck again into the presence of the scrubbed, new-shaven, neatly clad ship's company, with their officers sweating in formal broadcloth under the torrid sun, the familiar cry of "Jews and Roman Catholics fall out" comforted him, and he walked with an assured, seaman-like step to the small-arms chest that served as a lectern. The Jews and Roman Catholics did not, in fact, fall out any more than the various kinds of Muslim, the Orthodox Christians, or the plain wicked heathens. The congregation looked grave and even blank. But they grew more cheerful when Mr. Hare, an aspiring author, began his hesitant reading of a neighbour's sermon based upon a text from Job. "Oh, that my words were already written! Oh, that they were printed in a book!" Then came some familiar hymns, in which Paul Skeeping and Maggie Tyler, who knew the words, distinguished themselves, and a psalm which Awkward Davy sang in a strikingly true basso profundo. Mr. Hare dined in the cabin with the captain, of course, the first lieutenant and the surgeon, dined remarkably well, Valparaiso's victuals and livestock still being plentiful, and the chief supplier having thrown in a score of prime guinea pigs by way of compliment, while the exceptionally good Chilean wine positively encouraged excess. Not that Parson Hare needed any encouragement in his heartfelt relief at having delivered his sermon without a single blunder. Indeed, it couldn't truthfully be said that the wine was his undoing. The blame for that, if one is to sense your unsteady gait and a certain garrulity, must be ascribed to the United States rum, some bottles of which had survived the wicked cold and the even more wicked seas off the Horn. Jack Aubrey wasn't much given to censure, apart from instances of poor seamanship, being too conscious of his own faults in that direction. More than once he'd been obliged to be wheeled aboard in a barrow. But when it was time for leave-taking, he said that he and Stephen would see their guest home, not only to greet their fellow members of the Royal Society, but also to view the packet, and to ask her master about her behaviour under various combinations of sail in given winds. It was too reasonable to be refused, and when the surprise was heaved to so that the Ganymede could come closer, all three went on deck. The frigate's hands had been particularly gratified by the presence, the temporary presence, of an undoubtedly certificated parson, an admirable preacher, and as he took his seat in the bosun's chair, a kindly device that would raise him from the deck, swing him out over the side and so lure him into the boat without any exertion or ability on his own part, a disorganised cheer arose, gaining in unity and volume as the barge pulled over to the packet, where Hare's shipmates, aware of his weakness, had already rigged another chair to bring him aboard. "What an obliging fellow your master is," said Jack, coming back into Dobson's cabin after his inspection of Ganymede. "He answered all my questions like a right seaman. He has, in fact, sailed with several friends of mine, renowned as taut captains, and he told me many interesting things about Magellan Strait, too. What's more, he said that you'd spoken of barkentine which had touched at Cayo, where there were two other fair-sized merchantmen, one from Boston, the other belonging to Liverpool, as well as the Esmeralda moored over on the man-o'-war's side. Now, that brings me to the favour I have to ask of you." "I should be very glad to hear it," said Hare, looking at him earnestly. "It's my intention to stand into Callao, wind and weather permitting, fairly late in the evening of tomorrow or the next, and then endeavour to cut her out. We shall enter, not disguised, but with a peaceable, mercantile appearance, carry her by boarding in the dark, and if possible, carry her out. I shall take all the hands Ringle can spare, but leave her enough to bring the outcome to you lying off the port. She will also bring out a written account, a dispatch, and you will oblige me extremely by confiding it to your friends bound for England, begging them to deliver it to the Admiralty."
"I shall certainly do that. And I'm sure I can answer for my friends. Crossing the isthmus to the Atlantic coast is only a moderate day's ride, and I know they can expect no less than three ships ready to sail to the Pool of London. God give them a good wind and us a happy dispatch. Amen, amen, amen. For if it is even moderately happy, I should very much like my superiors to have it before they've completed the new South African squadron. Most ships have a killick or two aboard, but naval history records none with a more intense, persistent curiosity and want of scruple in employing his talents, so long as he was the only soul in the ship's company to know what the authorities, above all his captain, meant to do, the means were of no consequence. And they ranged, of course, from listening behind doors to the reading, lips in motion, of obviously extremely private letters. But this time he was disappointed. And if he had so low and false an opinion of his lower deck shipmates, a seasoned band of fighting seamen, as to suppose them ignorant of the destination of the iron balls they'd spent hours upon, chipping the iron off them and restoring their perfectly spherical appearance, and thus their power to fly straight, then he deserved to be. On Wednesday evening, the Surprise, looking as much like a merchantman as she decently could without culpable falsity, sailed into Callao with little abroad but her topsails and a jib, leaving Ganymede hull down in the west and Ringle about a mile off the coast there to wait for a signal, though most of her able hands had already been drafted to help serve the frigate's guns. With no appearance of haste, therefore, they glided in just before the top of the tide, her very young master steering her into battle according to naval custom. "Lay me for her larboard broadside, Mr. Hanson," said Jack, "and then bring her up when we're beam to beam." Already the Surprise's larboard watch were preparing the boats for launching. They were equipped with cutlasses, pistols, and sometimes, as in Davy's case, with a terrible boarding axe. Gently the frigate began her left-hand turn. The captains of the starboard guns kept them on their target with iron levers until Jack, taking the distance and the angle to be just so, gave the order, "From fore and aft, fire as they bear!" And to Hanson, "Back the fore and main topsails!" After the first three unanswered murderous broadsides, they hammered one another with shocking speed and ferocity, the Esmeralda replying very nearly shot for shot at first, but then, before the way was off her, Jack gave the order to fill the sails and put the helm hard over, bringing the fresh gun crews into the most violent action. The Peruvian's rate of fire diminished, as well it might with four of her 12-pounders dismounted. For nearly 2 minutes she was silent, for a shocking accident in the magazine meant that the guns couldn't be reloaded. Almost at the beginning of this ghastly pause, Jack cried, "Boarders away!" and leapt down into his barge. The larboard boats came round and up the Peruvian side as Jack's band made their way onto her deck, awkward Davies uttering his appalling roar. The Peruvians were now attacked before and behind, and although they rallied again and again, they were not used to this kind of battle, whereas the Surprises were, and use makes master. Gradually, the most part of the Esmeraldas were forced to escape below. But now the light was fading fast, and now the inexplicably silent artillery in the fortress guarding the naval port opened fire, each heavy gun shooting out a great tongue of flame. Jack's uniform had necessarily caught the Peruvian officer's attention, and for some time, as far as time can be reckoned in such encounters, he'd been extremely busy. Yet even so, his eye, the practiced eye of a predator, had caught the hoists of coloured lights rising to the mastheads of the two merchantmen in the harbour, position lights, obviously agreed upon beforehand. He backed out of the fray and roared for his coxswain, "Take any of the bargemen and any boat and pull like fury back to the ship. Tell Mr. Hewell from me to hoist coloured lights instantly and move the ship about. Cut along!" And he raced back into the dense mob fighting two and three deep, fighting all round the main hatchway, and a pistol bullet struck him in the left shoulder at very close range, knocking him flat, while a dark-faced man with a fixed devilish grin passed a sword clean through his thigh. The next moment, Darkface was utterly destroyed by a blow from Awkward Davies, an appalling blow. Young Hanson, unhurt so far, stood over Jack until he could pluck out the sword, and the two dragged him back to the Peruvian's shattered side. There, although for the moment he was unable to move, he saw with satisfaction that the gunners up there were now confused, firing at everything. He also saw, with great relief but no very great surprise, that the only Peruvians who hadn't gone below were now surrendering. He called to a group of Ringles he knew well and told them to stand by to unmoor. They stared at him with the wild, half-mad look of men who were or who had just been fighting to the death, and he hailed one of them, "Mr. Lewis, get these men to stand by to unmoor, and if you can lend me a cravat or a large handkerchief to tie up my leg, I should be obliged." But now some of the gunners up there, gathering his intention, redoubled their fire. Fortunately, it wasn't very accurate, and some were still concentrating on the Boston and Liverpool ships. Even so, if the Esmeralda were to be cut out at all, it would have to be done quickly. Helped by a seaman called Simon, he got to his feet and staggered to the starboard bow and the mooring. The frigate was very strangely made fast to the mole by a cable, a remarkably stout cable. He bawled all hands to loose topsails, fell forward, and saw young Hanson with an absurdly curved but obviously very sharp scimitar cutting away at the enormous rope while Davies levered it taut with a gunner's handspike. Hack! Hack! a deep breath, and a third blow with all his strength. The cable parted, and the ship, feeling the growing force of the ebb, swung free and moved a little way from the mole. Joy, and even a certain strength, flooded into Jack's being. "Hands loose, topsails!" he cried. "All hands there!" Then hoarsely, "Thank you, Horatio. You are a very good fellow. Now, take her out, will you?" Take her out he did, the ship being hit once or twice, but not seriously, out beyond the sheltering mole and into the darkness. And Jack felt a charming ease rise through the pain of his wounds, a pain that did not die away until he lost consciousness as they handed him down into his own sick bay. He was aroused not by the piping of all hands just before 8 bells in the middle watch, nor by the boatswain's mates bawling, "Starboard watch, ahoy, rise and shine, rouse out there, starboard watch-o," nor by the dread sound of 8 bells, nor yet by the noises of cleaning the decks with water, sand and holy stones, then swabbing them dry. What woke him from an unimagined depth of sleep was Stephen's whispered explanation of the mangled state of his shoulder. "The bullet struck the buckle of his sword belt, you see, flattening both metal and leather entirely, but leaving the bone intact. I see the crown deeply imprinted in his flesh. Yes, indeed. Surely he is beyond all reason fortunate, when you consider that his thigh was also transpierced without a single important artery being severed," replied Jacob. "Gentlemen, a very good morning to you," said Jack, out of the immense happiness that was welling in his full consciousness. "Is Esmeralda under our lee? Have we made a decent offing?" Somewhat taken aback, they said that she was, and that the shore could not be seen. "Give you joy," said Jack. He vented his own, a bubbling exultation and a croak of laughter, and said, "Pray give me something to drink. I'm horribly dry." Stephen held a jug to his lips, and he drank like a thirsty horse. They looked at him with a certain disapproval, and both felt his pulse. "It's scarcely reasonable," said Jacob aside, but then he always was a full-blooded man. And much louder, "Give you joy of your victory, sir, give you joy." "God bless you, my dear," said Stephen, gently shaking his hand. "It was a noble feat. But tell me, Jack, do you feel much pain?" "Not lying on my back, not to stop me sleeping. Lord, how I slept! Now I'm aware of my shoulder, and the bandage on my leg is a trifle tight, but God help us, after such a thrust, it ain't surprising. Tell me, could I be fed? Just a little thin gruel, if you like, but something to set me in train. I have a most important letter to write." "Fed?" they cried automatically. But then Stephen, who had known Jack's iron constitution for many years, said, "Thin gruel will not set you a-going. An egg beaten up with milk should make a splendid dispatch." "Lord, how well that went down," said Jack some minutes later. "Killick, pass the word for Mr. Harding." "Which is aboard the prize, sir," said Killick, exulting. "But we'll hail her." "Of course you will. Stephen, pray heave me up. I cannot dictate an official letter lying flat on my back." "You've already washed my face, I find. Thank you. Killick, there, pass the word for Mr. Adams." And when his clerk came in, "Mr. Adams, a good morning to you. I am about to write an official letter, so let's have excellent paper, excellent pens, and write black ink. Mr. Harding, there you are." "I'll take my leave," said Jacob. "Once again, sir, many, many congratulations." "Thank you very much. Stephen, pray don't stir. Mr. Harding, a very good morning to you. How does Esmeralda swim?" "Like a swan, sir. Very easy indeed. Not much damage?
Well, her larboard upper works are tolerably battered, her mizzen shot half through just under the top, and I've had to strike three guns down into the hold. And I'm afraid the forepart of her magazine is a wreck, but she is dry. No damage beneath the waterline, and with single-reefed courses and topsail, she goes along very well.
I'm very happy to hear it. Now I have to write the official letter, so please let me have the butcher's bill for both sides and the usual details. You're happy to sail her to Valparaiso, I take it? Oh, Lord, yes. And all the way home with some moderate patching, if you choose. But I'm afraid their losses with that damp, that horrible explosion in the magazine were very heavy. Yet the officers are a decent lot, most of them wounded, and very grateful to Dr. Jacob for his care. And the hands are much the same now. Their bosun and the carpenter's mate, the carpenter himself, was killed, have done what can be done to her mizzen until she can go alongside a sheer hulk. Our losses were fairly light, but there were some good seamen who will be sadly missed. I thought you'd need it, sir, so I've scribbled an exact list on our side and just approximate numbers on theirs. Though I did put their captain's name. Thank you very much, Mr. Harding. I shall let my letter off as soon as I can to Panama with the packet and so straight to London. Is there anyone you would particularly wish to be mentioned? Well, sir, there was Linklater Carpenter's crew who made us fast to her bows at the cost of his arm. And, of course, there was Mr. Hansen, who stood over you when you were pistoled by the main hatchway and who gave some shrewd blows. But I dare say you remember that. Indeed, I do, though I was half stunned for a moment. And I shall certainly remember Linklater. Thank you, Mr. Harding. By the way, where is Ringle lying? About half a mile on our larboard quarter, sir. And the packet? Perhaps another half mile beyond her. I couldn't ask better. And when Harding was gone, Stephen, I shouldn't like to lose a moment having this letter fair copied, so I shall say it slowly, deliberately. And if you hear anything that is low or bad grammar or just plain wrong, pray hold up your hand and we'll mend it before Adams has time to write it down. Brother, said Stephen after a moment's hesitation, you've reflected upon the peculiar difficulties of this letter, sure. Oh, this is not the first I've wrote, you know. Dear me, with guardian angels hovering about me like a pack of rooks, I've been blessed with occasion to write a dozen at least, some of them printed in the register. They are difficult, of course, and there are certain forms you have to learn. I generally begin with a usual and quite proper opening, Sir, or My Lord, as the case may be. It is with the greatest satisfaction that I have the honour to acquaint you for the information of the Lords Commissioners of the Admiralty that... And so on, always taking care to get your position, your latitude and longitude just so. A pause. And Stephen said, My dear, you're forgetting that this is not an ordinary matter for the board. You in command of Surprise, formerly a vessel belonging to the Royal Navy, brought her here on a hydrographical expedition with the added, but I think not expressed, condition that you should help the independent and republican Chileans to form a navy. It's true that some one of the many juntas appointed Lindsay, but since his death, I think it can be assumed that you command what naval force there is to be commanded. And it is surely to the rulers of this country that your letter should be addressed, to Don Bernardo O'Higgins, the Director Supremo, or his successor. After all, as I understand it, you mean to take the Esmeralda back to Valparaiso, and the possession of that very considerable man of war, together with what the Chileans already possess, absolutely guarantees the independence of their country. Everything depended on naval superiority, and now it's ours. With infinite concern, he'd been seeing Jack age before his eyes. It wasn't that he grew pale, he couldn't have been much paler, but all the living joy had drained out of his face. And now it was that of the Jack Aubrey of 70 or even more. Never grieve, brother, Stephen went on. The essence of the matter is unchanged, only the appearances seem to alter. All this has been entirely in line with the ministry's intentions, but they cannot yet be publicly expressed, far less avowed in print. Believe me, Jack, the Admiralty will be as pleased with this victory as if it had been won over an acknowledged enemy, and I don't doubt that they will take as much notice of your recommendations, while I'm very sure that the Supreme Director, on hearing the more than happy outcome, will absolutely assert that you did not exceed local orders given in a great emergency. Peru was actively preparing to invade the country. Dear Jack, I know about these things. Let me write a private letter to Sir Joseph, send it over by our brethren in the packet, and then a Spanish piece, announcing the Chilean victory that confirms the country's independence, to San Martin and O'Higgins, thanking them and their colleagues for their direction and their unfailing support. This, when you've signed it, will go racing on before us to Valparaiso. Jack smiled, a smile that was neither forced nor constrained, but that betrayed an immense weariness, and said, I do beg your pardon, Stephen. My wits were astray, and I was forgetting my real status. I should be most grateful if you would write both. And in Sir Joseph's letter, if you think proper, pray mention Horatio's conduct. After all, he did unmoor Esmeralda and sail her out under very heavy fire. I shall do that. And my Valparaiso letter will go by Ringle with all her amazing speed, for if I do not mistake, we and our prize must carry on at this sober pace. But, Jack, my dear, you've lost a terrible lot of blood. Your mind is sadly agitated, far more agitated than the situation warrants. And it's my considered opinion that you must eat as large a quantity of chicken soup as you can hold, and then take the comfortable draught that I shall mix you while the bird is preparing. All this time the surprise had been filled with the innumerable sounds of a ship being brought back to a state of high perfection, having been battered out of it, the continuous thump of caulkers, mallets, all along the frigate's engaged side, being the most obvious of the great variety. Surprisingly great, since a good half of the ship's company were aboard the crippled prize, which had been hit very hard, not only in the naval battle, but also by the fortress's 36-pounders. And it took Stephen some little time to find Killick, who was furtively smoking on the seat of ease. But when, with some vexation of spirit, Stephen at last had the nourishing broth in preparation, he and Jacob set themselves to composing and encoding the singularly difficult letter to Sir Joseph. At something very near the most critical point, a knock on the door almost wrecked their tense concentration. "Beg pardon, sir," said Killick timidly now, although he was backed by Maggie Tyler. "Which pole says the broth is ready?" "Very well," said Stephen, darting a furious look at him. "Maggie, as soon as it's cool enough, spoon it into the captain until he can no more. No forcing him, however, do you hear me there?"
"Yes, sir,"
whispered Maggie, aghast. "And he is to take this draught," holding up a purple phial, "3 teaspoons and count 60 after the first and second."
"60 it is, sir. As much as he can hold, then the draught, 3 teaspoons, and count 60 between the doses."
She'd never seen either doctor look so very severe, and she bobbed a double curtsy as she backed out, treading on Killick's feet. Another hour of intense concentration, and since they used a particular ink that could neither be effaced nor altered nor blotted, another hour of increasing squalor. Then, when both were satisfied and neither had quarrelled, which, where an encoding is concerned, says a very great deal, Stephen thankfully sealed the frail sheets and carried them first to the cabin for Jack's wavering signature. "Only half of him there at all, the poor dear soul," said Stephen to himself, and then on deck. "Mr. Sewell,"
he said to the officer of the watch. I should like to go aboard Ganymede, if possible, the Lisbon packet. And it doesn't seem worth troubling Ringle, particularly as the captain wishes her to make for Valparaiso as fast as ever she can sail. Why, sir, we'll lower down the blue cutter in a trice. She's easily the best sailor we have. Mr. Hanson, the blue cutter, if you please. Doctor, may I ask how the captain does? The people are right uneasy. I don't think they need to be. He was indeed dreadfully knocked about yesterday, particularly on the head and shoulder, and he lost a power of blood. But he's eaten well, and I think he's now asleep. Or very soon will be. Thank God, said Ewell. And several hands within hearing distance nodded with grave satisfaction. Even before he'd begun to think of himself as part of the Navy, and that because of strange but extensive areas of physical, mental and spiritual incompetence had been a very long period, even before his acceptance of a life as gregarious as that of the honeybee, Stephen Maturin had had a respect for the service and a kind of puzzled affection for sailors, particularly when they were aboard their own ships, those extraordinary hollow dwellings, sometimes as beautiful as they were comfortless. But never had he been so impressed as he was now, when a war-battered vessel, not a full day away from her bloody victory, produced and lowered down a trim, spotless cutter, at no more than three words from the officer and two notes from the boatswain's pipe, stepped her mast, and sent a boy running up the side to guide him down into the stern sheets, the cushioned stern sheets. "Where away, sir, if you please?" asked the coxswain. "The Lisbon packet. But tell me, how is William?" "Well, he copped it good and hearty, something cruel, but Dr. Jacob hopes to save the leg. Mind your head, sir, we're going about." The Ganymede's master altered course to close the cutter, and within a few minutes Stephen was aboard, clutching his bosom with maniac force, lest the papers that had cost so much and that had carried so much should escape during his frog-like progress over the gap between the cutter and the packet. He was safe, but he gasped for a while before handing the wrapper to Dobson, his very old friend, and, as an entomologist, a familiar of Sir Joseph Banks. Then, though he very earnestly wished them on their way, particularly Sclater and his friend, who were to traverse the isthmus and take ship at Chagres on the Atlantic coast, he received their very hearty congratulations and gave them a brief account of the action, as far as it could be made out from the surgeon's station and the cockpit. Back aboard the frigate, Stephen went straight below to his invalids. Jack, of course, was still asleep, and would be for a good while yet, if Poppy and Hellebore retained any virtue. But what was much more to the point was that his face had recovered a little something of its youth and happiness. At least it was no longer mortally stricken, while his shoulder, though an undeniably hideous bruise, showed no signs of infection, nor yet did his leg, which was distinctly less swollen. Stephen remembered how once he had spoken of Captain Aubrey's power of healing like a young dog, but under the influence of a certain piety, or perhaps of mere seaborn superstition, he brushed the thought aside and hurried into the sickbay to confer with Jacob, Paul and Maggie, satisfactory upon the whole, and so on to the cabin, where he threw himself into the composition of his letter to the Chilean authorities with great zeal and conviction. "A very fine letter indeed, dear colleague," said Jacob. "Even if I could suggest any change, which I cannot, since it seems to me that you have summed up the situation admirably well, insisting upon the imminence of the Peruvian invasion, the urgency of the Director Supremo's request, and the wholehearted support of your political advisers. But even if I could suggest any changes, I say I should not, because I know how you long to send Ringle away to Valparaiso, and any recopying for the sake, let us say, of a mere subjunctive would fret your spirit intolerably. Let us seal the letter, direct it to San Martin, and send it off without the loss of a minute." "What a good creature you are, Amos," said Stephen, shaking his hand. "Pray, warm the wax." And a few minutes later he said,
Mr. Harding, the captain, is still fast asleep. In his condition, sleep, quietness and rest are of the very first importance, and I should be most unwilling to disturb him. Yet the news of the victory should reach Valparaiso as soon as possible, and I am willing to take the fullest responsibility for desiring you to put a letter addressed to the Chilean authorities there aboard Ringle and directing Mr. Reed to deliver it as soon as ever he can. The letter is, of course, agreed between you and the captain. Yes, sir. Then I shall make Ringle's number at once. It was a joy to see the schooner come swiftly, smoothly under Surprise's lee, the stiff breeze being in the west-nor-west, pick up the message, repeat the orders, and pelt away southwards under such a press of canvas that she was hull down before Stephen left the deck. By all accounts, the reception of the news in Valparaiso had been ecstatic. Music and dancing all day and all night, speeches, more speeches, heroic drinking on the part of the Royal Navy and some Indians from the inland parts, widespread allegations of unchastity. But the beautiful west winds that Jack Aubrey had so often praised as being perfect for the Strait of Magellan, and that had indeed brought Ringle down at such a pace, often touching 15 knots watch after watch, soon turned foul. Dead foul. When they were trying to beat round Cape Angamos, the prize lost her mizzen with its top and everything above, which delayed them horribly. Still, they did arrive to a fair amount of popular enthusiasm, to official speeches by the score, and, of course, to splendid dinners. And it was while he was preparing for one of these, said to be the last before Carrera's departure, that Jack's ill temper, his invalid's ill temper, worried Stephen extremely, as the possible sign of a late developing complication from one or other of his wounds. He'd been extremely active, getting out long before Stephen and Amos thought wise, and throwing himself into the repair of Esmeralda, the refurbishing of O'Higgins and Lindsay's Asp, and the fitting out of the little squadron of sloops in which he and some of his officers trained the abler young Chileans, a singularly agreeable band. This time, he meant to take them on at least part of his surveying of the Chonas Archipelago, but that depended very much on how his plans for the evening went. Extremely active, and now he was extremely tired, as well as somewhat irritable, not to say cross-grained, he was much thinner, he walked with a stick, and he was more snappish than his oldest shipmates could remember. "I do wish you'd stop pressing the goddamn place," he said to Stephen, who was dressing the leg again before he put his breeches on. "It's hellish tender." He checked himself. Stephen took no notice. He was wholly intent upon searching for proof of the deep infection that he dreaded and that he had seen before in just such a wound. But finding neither confirmation nor disproof, he bound up the gash again, whipping the bandage round and crosswise with a wonderful dexterity. "I couldn't do that," said Jack when it was finished. "Thank you very much. I'm sorry I called out just now." "You're a forgiving creature, Stephen. I'm afraid I need a good deal of forgiving these days, you know. Of course, I'm out of sorts in spite of our battle with many good men lost, old shipmates, and the frigate so knocked about. But what really worries me, Stephen, is the discontent. The hands haven't been paid. The prize money has not been shared out. And when we reach Valparaiso, the men will not be able to afford a sailor's pleasure. And you know what that is as well as I do. Indeed, almost certainly better from the sick berth. They know it's dangerous, but they do love it. And if they can't have it, they grow chuff, rough, and push too far, downright mutinous. I know very well what you mean." "You do, do you?" asked Jack, looking at him intently, but asking no questions. "Yes. And the other officers have seen signs of it. If we were well found and at sea, I shouldn't worry. But we're likely to be ashore off and on for a fair while, and Jack ashore is often an ass. Apart from anything else, he can desert. Furthermore, as well as many well-tried old shipmates, we have some right hard men aboard.
We're all right for stores for the next few weeks. And I've told Adams to hand out $2 a head, but when stores and dollars are gone...
I could wish you didn't have this dinner,
said Stephen. But you will go easy with the wine, will you not? If you see me offer to take even half a glass too much, pray give me a kick. This wouldn't have been difficult, since the invariable practice at these often repeated ceremonies was to seat Dr. Matcher in between Captain Aubrey and the most important guest, so that Jack's unwavering ignorance of any foreign language, other than a very, very little French, might be less of a hindrance.
I hear the trumpets, said Jack.
And indeed, at all these splendid entertainments, although he was conveyed by coach, he was attended by drums and trumpets, which even now still evoked a fair amount of cheering. The guests were very politely received in the great hall, and Jack was seated at the right hand of the Junta's president, Miguel Carrera, with Stephen, smaller than either and on a somewhat lower chair, interposed for translation. Jack had never grown used to the Spanish hours of eating, and his appetite had vanished even before it even smelt the soup. But Stephen, who had been brought up to these times for meals, admired his steady calm as the many, many courses dragged their slow length along. He did speak from time to time by means of Stephen, usually answering questions about the men of war, the quality of the young men training to be naval officers. Excellent, said Jack, with strong emphasis. Excellentissimo. Stephen did sincerely admire his steadiness, his frequent smile. But it was with dismay that he heard Jack's discreet murmur, after a capital dish of strawberries, desiring him to tell the president that Captain Aubrey begged the favour of a word once the feast was ended.
Of course, replied Carrera, I should be honoured, and please tell the captain that I have had very good news from Santiago. The Supreme Director tells me that the grant of the estate has been confirmed by a unanimous vote, and please convey my very best congratulations.
Stephen did so, and he saw Jack smile, bow, and say that he earnestly hoped all due thanks for the present might be transmitted to the Director. Scarcely were these words uttered, but the bishop's chaplain, followed by all others present, rose to say grace. The whole company waited for the bishop and his attendants to leave, bowing as the old gentleman passed. And then Carrera showed Jack and Stephen into a domed, octagonal room with Moorish sofas and coffee and a Christian decanter of brandy.
I was so glad to be able to bring you the news of your great estate, said Carrera, as they sat down. It is a little far away, and it has been neglected by the former owner, a royalist, of course. But with the river just at hand, there are great possibilities of irrigation, and after all, 6,000 acres is scarcely negligible.
As he listened to Stephen's expressionless translation, Jack looked at the ground. It was pretty gross. Surprisingly gross in a Spaniard. Clearly, the man was uneasy, as he might well be. The land in question lying in an arid stretch of country south of the Biobío River, inhabited as far as it was inhabited at all by Araucanian Indians, the most formidable and warlike of their kind, while much of the land was thickly covered with the Chilean pine, the puzzle monkey tree.
No, indeed, said Jack, and as I've said, I'm sure you will convey all suitable expressions of my gratitude to the Supreme Director. But for the moment, I'm primarily concerned with my men. As you're aware, they've not been paid. The very considerable mass of treasure seized at Valdivia has not been shared out, and the people of the prize court here say that no decision on the Esmeralda's value can possibly be reached this year. No. Let me finish speaking, if you please, he said, holding up his hand, and Carrera obviously thought his cold fury as impressive as did Stephen. Since I reached this country, Jack went on, I have been referred from ministry to secretariat from high-placed men to influential friends and back again. And my people, in the height of victory, have not sixpence in their pockets for a pot of beer, and I tell you, sir, this will not do. You, a man of great standing in the Republic, are going to Santiago. I desire you to tell Mr. O'Higgins and your other colleagues that this will not do. I must have money, and only a great deal of money will satisfy my officers and men. They must have what they've earned and what they've won, and they must have it by the end of the month. Do you understand me, sir?
I understand you, sir, said Carrera. And you will allow me to say that I very much regret the present state of affairs. I must set out for Santiago early tomorrow morning, and there I shall lay the matter before those who make decisions. But before I go, I shall do myself the honour of sending a letter to your ship, to your most distinguished ship. You're very good, sir, said Jack, standing up with the help of his stick. And it only remains for me to thank you most heartily for this truly splendid feast. I particularly valued the Christmas pudding, he added with a look of fury, and for your comprehension. Finally, may I beg you to tell your colleagues that the end of the month is my fortunate or unfortunate day, as they shall decide. With this he held out his hand and said farewell. By God, you did that in style, brother, said Stephen when they were in the coach. I couldn't dislike the man, although he's a politician, said Jack, and I believe he loves the service. He has a nephew aboard Gladiator, speaks perfect English, and thinks of himself as at least half a sailor already. And he's not far wrong. It was the early rising half that was entrusted with the letter, and it was delivered aboard Surprise before Jack's vile morning draught, which Killick brought with eager punctuality at four bells, and which had to be swallowed before he might open the envelope. Go and see whether the doctor's about, said Jack, and if he is, ask him to look in when he has a moment.
Which he's in the fish market, churning over some old-fashioned lobsters. No, I tell a lie, that's him falling down the companionway and cursing in foreign.
Stephen, dusted down and tweaked into good order, his wig restored, was led into the cabin.
Good morning, Stephen. Would you cast an eye at this?
Bless you, said Stephen, I might.
Don Miguel kisses your hands, thanks you for honouring his frugal repast, and has the happiness of enclosing two papers, the one being addressed to the chief cashier and requiring him to deliver 5,000 pieces of eight to any inferior officer whom you may choose to send, the other to the official in charge of naval stores, charging him to send over everything of that kind you may require. He begs your pardon 1,000 times for so brief a scribble, but his horse, a desperately impatient animal, is at the door, only just held by two straining grooms.
By God, that's very handsome of him, cried Jack. As soon as we've had breakfast, let us call upon the dear cashier with a couple of powerful holders, and then confer with the master, purser, bosun, gunner, and anyone who's concerned with stores to find just what we need. I know the cupboard's most uncommon bare.
He went on about its barrenness at considerable length, a length matched by his own exhilaration. But when for a moment he paused, Stephen said, "Will I tell you something?"
"By all means. It'll probably be even more interesting than the number of swabs we need. Listen, I was walking along the dockside where they are repairing the big Chilean frigate."
"O'Higgins."
"No, sir, if you'll forgive me. They are changing it to San Martin."
"Are they, by God? That's a damned unlucky thing to do to a ship. And it may be unlucky for us, too. Clearly the tide's changing. O'Higgins was our friend."
What little I saw of San Martin I did not care for, and I doubt he really loved me. But there's little we can do about it, apart from knocking the place down about their ears with their own powder and shot, and that I hesitate to do, having several friends in this town. Now, I think we must carry on with our survey. And if they turn awkward, if they shuffle or backwater, why, damn them all, I shall ask you to write me a handsome letter of resignation. Pray for a steady west wind and sail home. But first, until the month is out, I must fulfil my promise and take the young men, the pick of the young men, surveying the Chaunus Archipelago. And before that, we must fill the ship with stores. At four bells in the forenoon watch the next day, a very pretty day with Jack's beloved westerly breeze rippling the harbour, surprises Gunner, in answer to a nod from Summers, fired the foremost larboard gun. All those who had been poised to act, waiting for this signal, instantly cast off moorings, raced aloft, and watching surprise with the closest attention, followed her movements with such exemplary success that the whole squadron of four ship sloops and one frigate moved steadily across the harbour in an exactly straight, exactly spaced line, and amid the cheers and applause of the multitude into the open sea, where, again following the example of surprise, they all steered southwest by south to allow for the heave of the moderately powerful swell and making tide. According to local custom, the sloops had two captains, a first and a second, and Jack had them on the quarterdeck by turn each daylight watch, or, to be more exact, from four bells in the morning watch until the end of the first dog, to show them how things were done in the Royal Navy. Three or four of them were quite fluent in English, particularly young José Fernández, Carrera's nephew, a natural-born merman if ever there was one. But even so, the monoglots imposed a dreadful burden on Dr. Maturin, who, though he knew a few nautical terms, such as starboard and larboard in English, had no notion of how to say come up the tackle fall in Spanish or any other language. "How I wish we had Jacob," said Jack one day off Talcahuano. "It was entirely with your own consent that we left him in Valparaiso for the possible transmission of a particular message," said Stephen. "You're entirely right, I beg your pardon, brother. It was just for the relief of bewailing my lot. An ignoble relief, I admit. Captain, dear, a glass of wine with you." In his youth, Jack Aubrey had served under two taut captains, remarkably taut even for those rigorous days, and when he said exercising, he meant it to a degree that left the poor young men pale, wan, and almost dropping as they stood. But after a few days, their young frames, having slept like the dead and eaten like hyenas, gained strength. Above all, as his own young midshipmen and younger officers raced them from one dizzy eminence to another. And although they had already been through some fairly serious naval training, Dr. Maturin had to treat many a blistered hand and rope-burnt thigh. Yet in all this, there was none of the harsh driving so usual at sea. And as far as cheerfulness and good nature were compatible with reefing a foretopsail and a very fresh breeze, the days were, upon the whole, cheerful and good-natured. The only occasions upon which Jack was less than kind were those upon which the young Chilean showed a really grave ignorance of navigation, of determining the ship's course and position by the principles of geometry and nautical astronomy. Here he found Daniel and Hansen of the greatest use, and although a lunar observation was harder to understand than a sheet bend, most of the young men were convinced of the subject's importance, and several learnt to take the sun's altitude at noon. They were invited, usually in pairs, to dine in the cabin or the gunroom, and although language sometimes presented a certain amount of difficulty, voracious appetites made up for it. "What a pleasant set of young fellows they are, to be sure," said Jack Aubrey, as he and Stephen walked on a strand by the mouth of the River Lico. "And many of them have a real sense of the wind and the sea. At least half a dozen will make real sailors.
Lord, what a change after those miserable, untrustworthy politicians. Sure, you're in the right of it. But tell me, Jack, what are they doing to the poor Surprise, all awry there on the face of the ocean? Why, since it's so still and we so prettily embayed till the turn of the tide, Harding thought of showing the rest of the boys, those who didn't pull us ashore, what half breaming is like. Do you see, they've heaved her down as far as they decently can, and they're scraping the weed from what bottom they can reach. His explanation went on, but presently he noticed that Stephen was looking very fixedly at a bird, by now quite remote. "I do beg pardon, Jack," he said, "but I'm almost certain that was a snipe. Did you see it yet?" "Certainly not, and should give it no countenance if I did. A snipe in Chile, for all love. I should as soon expect a beaver in the Royal Exchange." "And yet that dear boy Jose, whose uncle is a great shot, told me that the snipe, Becasina, Gallinago Gallinago, the same bird as ours, was the very first of breeding birds that come down here on migration. Bless you. Here I'd been cursing the day and kicking the ground itself because we were making this voyage, as we have made so many a voyage, in that dismal gap when the winter migrants have departed and those of the spring have not yet arrived. I'm filled with hope." Filled he may have been, but days, even weeks later, he was sitting on the grey pebbles of an island, one of the innumerable cold grey Chonas Islands, sullenly training his glass not on any wildly exotic migrant, but the commonplace, resident, blackish but white-footed oyster catcher, wading about in search of its living. Farther along there was another, a lacklustre female, and neither betrayed the slightest interest in the other. Clearly this was not their breeding season, whatever the snipe might think. Not the season of sudden joys, although it was indeed the 30th day of the month, and tomorrow must decide Jack's fate one way or another, neither leading to any evident happiness. Beyond the hen oyster catcher, a brig came into view, rounding one of the countless rocky eminences that Captain Aubrey and his pupils had surveyed that morning with infinite care. They were now surveying another, a little way to the south of Stephen's sight, but within that of the brig, which now increased its already headlong speed with yet more canvas. A green brig, familiar to Stephen, used as a yacht by a wealthy and amiable Chilean gem merchant, one of Jacob's friends who lived in Valparaiso. He fixed it with his telescope, and there indeed was Jacob, looking at him through another and making signs. Untimely mirth. Whatever the signs were, they were very soon lost as the brig rounded yet another great sea-worn cliff in the direction of Surprise, and Stephen's attention was at once seized by a very noble sight. Two black-necked swans flying steadily south, quite low over the water, so low that he could hear the rhythmic beating of their wings. "I cannot just sit here watching pale-footed oyster catchers," said Maturin aloud, "but what other course is open to me?" No other course during the passage, always north to south, of three skuas and that revolting carrion eater, the crested caracara, hung about Stephen's neck and wrapped in waxed silk bags, one inside the other. A small and very beautiful repeating watch chimed two quarters and would have chimed a third, had he not caught sight of the frigate's jolly boat pulling fast into the contrary wind. He leapt up and waved and hooted, terrifying the oyster catchers, but making quite sure that he was not marooned. He came up the ship's side with his usual elegance, and he was greeted by Dr. Jacob, on whose brow a knowing eye could read, "A coded signal has come through." Stephen was led below to one of the really discreet parts of the ship, and in a low voice, Jacob said, "Jaime brought it just after the government messenger had arrived from Santiago." And although Jacob had not decoded anything like the whole, there was an important section that he perhaps mistakenly thought should be transmitted to the person concerned at once. From the jerk of his head and upward look, Stephen grasped that he was speaking of Jack. And this became yet more certain when Jacob spoke of his delight when the brig overtook and passed the heavy sloop of war that had set out from Valparaiso before he could find the owner of the brig. "You have the original and your transcript?" asked Stephen. "The original, but only a little of the transcript. Let me show you how far I went before deciding to come out." Stephen held the rough draft to the gunport and said, "Certainly you were quite right, dear Amos. We must tell him at once." "No, he is your particular friend. Here is my copy of the D2 key. There are some difficult combinations that I didn't trouble with, but the essence is quite plain and we can worry them out later." Stephen nodded, shook his hand warmly, thrust the papers into a pocket and walked quickly out. Almost running into the clerk, he said, "Mr. Adams, pray do me a service. I should like a private word with the captain. I shall be in the cabin." Adams stared at so very extraordinary a request, but he saw that Stephen was in earnest, said, "Very good, sir," and hurried on deck. Stephen was gazing out of the middle stern window when the captain came in, looking surprised and a little concerned. "Jack," said Stephen, "a signal has just come in. It has not all been decoded, but the opening is addressed to you by name and ship. And if you choose, I will read you what has been made out and try to decode the rest as I go. It's been crumpled in the journey, and I may miss some words. But here is the essence. Immediately upon receipt of the present order, you will proceed to the River Plate, there joining the South African squadron. You will go aboard HMS Implacable and take command of the squadron, hoisting your flag blue at the mizzen." Jack sat down, bowing his face in his hands. He was almost unmanned. But after a moment he said, "Read that again, will you, Stephen?" Stephen did so. And Jack said, "By God, Stephen, I'm so glad it was you brought me this news. Sophie will be so happy. By God, I never thought my flag had come. And there are some other things. Very hearty congratulations from the Duke of Clarence for the Callao action, a personal message to Horatio Hansen, and a request that you should send him home as soon as possible to sit for his lieutenant's examination. And there are great quantities of political considerations from Sir Joseph that have yet to be decoded. May I too congratulate you, Admiral dear?" He embraced Jack, who took it quite naturally in something of a daze. But then he said, "It's all very glorious, brother, and I'm glad they're pleased with us. But I'm tied by the leg, you know. I'm engaged, committed to the Chilean government." At this point, the Chilean government, in the person of Carrera, was coming up the surprises side from the heavy ship sloop, carrying a letter. He was properly received by Harding, and, permission having been sought, he was shown into the cabin, where Jack offered him some sherry and begged pardon while he read the letter. "I am very sorry for what it contains," said Carrera. "Sorry and ashamed. The men in Santiago beg for another 3 months, and then all debts will be paid. It grieves me to say this to you, Sir Jack, but you will recall our agreement. I must desire you to take your young men, your excellent and most promising young men, aboard the sloop. For I am required to sail in another direction. But please rest assured of my personal esteem for you and of my very best possible wishes for the Chilean Navy of the future." The transfer took a considerable time, a very cheerful, good-humoured transfer, And the ships parted with hearty reciprocal cheering. After a last salute, Jack glanced aloft, still the sweet west wind, and then he looked fore and aft. A fine, clear deck, hands all at their stations and all beaming with pleasure. And turning to the master, he said, "Mr. Hanson, pray lay me a course for Cape Pilar and Magellan Strait."
The End. You've been listening to Blue at the Mizzen by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.